together an educational package, most people didn't do very well. In fact, they came out looking rather stupid in the process. They had a collection of, you know, who knows what, and it wasn't applicable. So there is, I think, something in favor of the arts and sciences that derives from the fact that students do need to find something to do with what they learn that isn't always just strictly career-oriented, so that I think there is a student interest in those kinds of educational experiences that require something of them, that are demanding, that build self-reliance, self-discipline, self-initiative, teach them basic skills, as you well know, that they see all of these things as important or growing in importance to their lives. And the arts and sciences, you know, can provide a disciplined approach to learning, and that students, I think, are increasingly receptive to it. What I think the arts and sciences have to face is that the materials they're using to achieve this goal are probably going to have to change. That the total reliance on what you got your PhD in is probably not going to be sufficient. Historical materials or political materials and the like are going to have to be updated. They're going to have to be looked at in different ways to get students to be interested in them. What the arts and science people will miss is that there will be fewer students, I think, simply sitting at the feet of a Milton professor just to be at the feet of a Milton professor, irrespective of Milton. And so that I think we have people on the faculty in those disciplines who are alert to that, who do adapt their materials and their approaches, but are still getting across the idea of what intellectual development is in the arts and sciences. So I think they're going to be able to avoid a simple run on what everyone fears, teach me accounting, you know, 1 through 1,000 so I can go out and keep books. Period. And I don't think this argument that people need to change at many points in their lives is without merit. People are beginning to accept the notion that I want to have some capability of altering my life. And I think the 60s and early 70s, while people talked about their own thing in their own bag, what they really were doing was drifting along and letting a lot of forces shape them, and they were saying, wow, take me, you know, and I'll develop. Now they're talking much more about the hard business of saying, I've got to shape my life, and I need some help in shaping my life, and not the help in the sense I want you to shape it for me, mm-hmm. but I want to be able to develop the ability to shape it. And I think that's one of the reasons I stick by our students being treated as adults, being independent in the non-instructional area, because I think if we run a good service administrative show here and deliver the services that are promised in a professional, efficient way, mm-hmm. people learn from that, and that they learn that they can cope with agencies and offices and people and bureaucrats, so that they aren't always turning to other people to cope with the day-to-day activities and getting dependent on social service personnel, as an illustration. And one of the big things about our EOF program is that I think it does emphasize how do you cope with something yourself, not how do you always run to someone and say, I can't do this for me kind of business. And that's one of the major, I think, things in our so-called student service or generally support service area, is the emphasis, first of all, on the institution providing good services, that the people know what they're to do, and when, you know, students need these services to which they have rights, that they're well provided and the student learns how to use them. And I think in this last year, with the students doing such things as passport programs for orientation, intercom programs for information and self-help, you know, that makes me feel we've made progress, that students see that they can do that, and not only that they can do it, but they can teach other people to do it. So I think that has been a rewarding part of that. It's been painful to a lot of people I know along the way, but I have the gut feeling that students, if you ask students about it, do they think this place, you know, basically provides what they were told it would provide, mm-hmm. they'll say yes. And I think they have a high regard for that. And I don't think many of them really would say, oh yeah, I personally want and need all those kind of personal support services that people talk about. They'll say, yes, they're nice, sort of in the abstract, and if they're going to be provided and someone's going to pay for them, well, why not have them? I understand that. But when you put the question to them a little differently in terms of their own need for it, their own use of it, their own payment of it, and they go, well, no, I don't need that sort of stuff, and I don't want to pay for it anyway.
Okay.
So I think we've made a lot of progress in that area, and I think that's taken grinding from the top. It has been consistently an unpopular point of view, but since popularity is not, you know, very important in changing things, that we just kept going at it. And I had, you know, trustees who thought I ought to be sent away to another island, as well as an enormous number of faculty, a small number of vociferous students, and a large collection of very dubious staff. But I think a lot of people have changed on that issue.
We can move over to the internal governance situation and decision-making process. I wonder, Dick, if you could talk for a few minutes about the differences between the way that you intended Stockton's governance system to work, the major differences on the one hand, and the way traditional collegial faculty-run institutions had worked in the past. In other words, what was your objection to the traditional way of handling college decision-making and then the major alternative that you proposed to it? And then maybe we can do the specific stuff a little later.
It's very important for this question that we remember when Stockton started. And it started at the time the collective negotiations law really had just come into effect for New Jersey higher education. And that it's important to remember that it was I who wrote the governor's veto message for higher education, and he did veto higher education being part of it, and it was overridden. And that being the case, that's the law, and that's the way things are going to be. It seemed to me appropriate that we, first of all, operate on the assumption we are going to develop the best system of operating within the intent as well as the specifics of that law. And that made it very clear that there would be a managerial executive group, which is stated by law. That's the terminology used. That's not my invention. And it made it very clear that the employees, represented by a collective negotiations agent, would be, in fact, represented solely by that agent. And so that was the clear model. It's a model that I'm often accused of inventing, but it's very much in the statute. What I'm really accused more of is interpreting and implementing it literally, and which is correct. That is a correct interpretation. And so my goal was to provide the best way of operating within this new system. I came out of all the traditions that are associated with faculty governance, and that may have been an interest of mine, a way of going.
Could I interject just a moment to ask you whether you viewed this new model as an unfortunate inevitability or as something that might in fact be a better way of running a college than it had been run traditionally?
Well, I didn't view it as an unfortunate inevitability. I don't believe in a democracy you can linger over those things very long. If that's the will as represented by statute, I can be its critic up to that point. Then I don't go around saying how unfortunate, how sad these things occur. I said in business, making it the best kind of system of doing one's business. And as you have heard me say and others on many occasions, if you want to have strong leadership prospects at the top, this model is an outstanding vehicle for initiative from the top. Clearly a very, very effective way of presidents, vice presidents, deans, whatever you like, being initiators, being very strong leaders. And that's what the law intended. They were to be the executives of the institution. And that we had the circumstance of not having in place any other form of governance or any traditions. So that I, at the very outset, argued that collective negotiations and traditional faculty governance were not compatible. And particularly in crisis situations, when, again, pushing and shoving came along, the union would have to assert its primacy, at least, and it has the statutory base to do that. So I've always been among those group who consider collective negotiation incompatible with most of the traditional faculty governance patterns, and as a consequence, you should make the changes to accommodate to that. And if the faculty wanted to find additional ways of participating in what we call decision-making or governance, most of that would have to be left to them to determine, and that the institution would take a relatively passive role in that. We would be accommodating, and supportive in a sense of providing material space and accommodations and schedule, all of that so that people could have freedom of assembly and discussion and the like. But we would not put ourselves in a position where what we propose to do would be in any way subject to their approval, and that we couldn't move without their concurrence. We certainly wanted their advice and opinion, which some people don't think that's not adequate, but we were not going to put ourselves in the position of compromising the statute or our now managerial positions by seeking prior approval. It's obviously a political process where you have to have an understanding of whether or not there's any support for something, but there are many ways that we've been able to ascertain that without going the approval route.
Do you think, Dick, comparatively, knowing what has traditionally gone on in higher education and then looking at Stockton over the last 8 or 9 years, that this governance model that we've done better, perhaps, as an institution or worse as an institution than we would have had we been permitted the luxury of the other one? In other words, are you happy with this governance model? To some degree, we had it imposed on us by virtue of of the collective negotiations, but do you think it's been generally good for the institution, or would we have been better off if we could have gone a more traditional route?
Well, I think we're better off in the sense that we were able to formulate our goals and objectives and find means of pursuing those in a rather, rapid fashion. It's probably one of the most important things that governance in the traditional sense would change is the pace of the institution, because more people, more levels, right? It takes more time. Mm-hmm. And there are ugly jokes about committees and how long they take and what comes out at the end. So that the pace of the institution would have been, I think, dramatically different. And to the extent that that's important, and I think it's very important to be a highly responsive, fast-moving kind of institution in these days, I think this is by far the best route to go, and the people here have benefited greatly. The other feature that I think would be changed is that democracies with extensive participation and levels and reviews and approvals and the like by various groups and individuals inevitably lead to a whole range of compromises, pursuits of self-interest, scratch my back, scratch yours kinds of things. And I don't say that in a negative way. That's part of a democratic political process. I think we would have had a much less dramatic educational program, much less imaginative approaches to pedagogy, course organization, because the feelings about we did it this way from wherever we came from, and these are the ways things are done in higher education, those forces would be very, very strong. And as a footnote to that, remember, Stockton also was, at that time, and still is to some extent, an institution without significant seniority. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, you throw all of the wet-behind-the-ears people together, and they have to find a way of building. There's no authority, there's no experience, so there you are. And you're all mucking around in this thing until everyone gets enough of what he or she wants that they can, okay, or they get, remember the faculty meetings that were marathons. The winners of the meeting were those who had the greatest physical stamina or probably just could sleep through the first part of it and come back to life in the second part of it. Now, that's no way, in my judgment, to get a very interesting or dynamic or even sensible kind of program. So I obviously, having been part of the perpetrator group of this approach, have to argue that it has produced an institution that, as I've said before, outsiders think is a marvel, and most outsiders say, oh, I wish I had half the things that you have going for you there. And insiders, although they don't jump up on tables very often to say, you know, the administration, let alone the president, did the right thing, I do understand in various ways that as people talk about what it is they can and cannot do in this institution, how well things run and this sort of thing, do believe that they have something that's very good. And as I mentioned earlier, they also, the more they can compare us with someone else, I think the better they will feel about it, the more they'll recognize that things here are in a position that they as individuals and even as groups and faculty can derive benefit from it. There is not necessarily happiness coming out of peer activity. There are all kinds of tyrannies that can occur, and you can put a lot of people together who are called faculty or students or staff and say, okay, we're letting you do these things and we expect it. There are all kinds of petty tyrannies and fiefdoms and whatnot that emerge in that. And this, I believe so strongly in the student government aspect of it, that my own experience with student government and reading all the literature and keeping always current on it, that is probably the most tyrannical group of people I'd ever met, the so-called student government leaders.
How much bubble up do you think we got over the course of the college's existence? I understand what you're saying to be that, aside from giving us a capacity for fast reaction and some sort of coherent policy, when that policy is initiated by the leadership, that another possibility of the governance structure that Stockton has is that by cutting out the intervening layers of student government or faculty committees, that good ideas can bubble up from individual students or individual faculty members and get acted on much more quickly than they could otherwise. What were your expectations, Dick, as to how much of that was going to happen and how much of it has happened in your mind in terms of individuals, making a contribution, yeah, both from the faculty and student ranks?
Well, our self-study for accreditation, with which you're familiar, addressed that issue a bit and gave it a reasonably favorable grade. You're talking about the notion, I often say, that the best idea, irrespective of source, should be able to win the race, and that the race ought not to be too long and too tortured. But my expectations at the beginning may have been naive or overly optimistic, was that that could work, that we could avoid some of the hurdles and impediments that go with traditional institutions, some that are psychological, some that people simply would resist. And I probably exaggerated my own ability to be open, accessible, and responsive to those, although I think I was reasonably so. And a lot of people did come and suggest a lot of things that were maybe crazy, and a lot of things that were very good. I think we have had instances where students have been the initiators of ideas that have to do with grading, faculty with honors. Various things have come up through the institution. There have been new programs that certainly have come up that way. And I think you take a whole area such as basic skills and or general education. The power of a few initiators, I think, in the institution is really substantial. So whereas maybe everyone isn't running in with a good idea and the like, a substantial number of people have done that, and we've put together little groups like task forces and not even that formal group, and things have come up. And my own belief is that the response time in this institution to such initiatives is very fast. And not only is the time fast, that I'm speaking now for myself, the nature of the response is substantially more than yes, no. So that it reflects a careful analysis. It often produces a counter-argument, or produces alternatives, or other ways, you know, why don't you check this, that, and that there are opportunities for interplay in that. And something I have difficulty with is that in those arguments, so to speak, I like to think of myself, and this is fantasy, of course, as sort of being on the same level as the proposer. You know, I'd like to argue it out with the proposer, and my critics remind me, well, the president can't get away with that because there are lots of things the president can't avoid carrying with him or her into the argument. And so I am naive a bit on that subject, but you know, I think generally approach people. When the students came in, for example, with the thing we just mentioned, the intercom, you know, two students walked into my office. I didn't know what they were going to walk in and talk about. And as they told me later, you know, they were terrified of the possibility, I guess because someone said I shoot fire and, you know, eat people alive or something. They came in and sat down and said, we have this proposition. And they had thought it through very carefully. They made a nervous but very good presentation of it. And I said, you know, here's some ideas, here's some questions, and you look at it and like, do you have something to give me to look at? Yes, they did. Took it, and you know, about in a week, we were in business, and you know, they got all their money, they got all their staff, they got telephones, they got everything. Everything was done, and now they're an integral part of the budget unit. So people can, in a sense, I think, walk in off the street because we desperately need those ideas. And I don't think, continuing that illustration, that if those students had to go through student government, through various deans of students, and layers of this and layers of that, that the president would have ever heard of it, frankly. And if he or she did, it would be after these students had graduated, the ones who proposed it. And I think it's very important that there be that access of ideas as well as very timely responses so people don't waste their time.
Dick, what does this kind of governance system do to your relationships with your staff people? Now, the faculty discussions of governance at Stockton and the student discussions, at least on the part of the vocal portion of the student body, have been pretty much out in the open. But to say that you have a system where final authority is concentrated at the top and the best idea wins does, I think, strip some prerogatives of office from people who might say, I am the vice president of thus and such, and therefore my advice ought to be accepted on this as a matter of course. What's your reflection based on your experience at this place about the degree to which this kind of a governance system works out well with respect to high-level administrative staff? Are they uncomfortable with it? Do they resent it? Have they become accustomed to it? And how well does it work on the administrative level?
Well, I do think they resented it at the outset. Because they had to deal with the very real prospect that I would not take simply on the face of it what they said or recommended, that no one in the institution could get away with, if you like, simply being, having his or her point of view accepted because of position or place in the organization, that everything was open to question. Now, I can only say on the other side that there have been a lot of people who have in no way been reluctant to attack and question me on my staff. As you know, the first assistant to the president was a tiger on that, and other people have done that. I think some of them have found that it's not even very risky, and that I do very often change. But it is a very unusual administrative arrangement, because I also have the practice and think it important in administration that the president or a vice president from a dean, there's a great danger in taking the next level of administration down their recommendation and feel that you're absolutely obliged to support them and to do that. If you aren't going to support them, obviously you should work with them. You know, work down through them, back through them, and have the full opportunity for them to know and to try to persuade you. But everyone has to be prepared to being reversed. Mm-hmm. You know, that's got to be that. The other element of it is I'm, you know, well known and maybe not favorably known for not sticking exclusive, not becoming the captive of the formal channels of communication. you know, I do my own observing, do my own listening, do my own, you know, walking around, and, you know, I get accused of knowing where all the light bulbs are out and all these things in the institution. I'm a looker and a listener, and insist on developing my own ways of trying to put things in perspective, primarily that I hear, not say, you know, you're absolutely right, you're absolutely wrong, just because I heard this so-called horseback theory of survey. But what I tend to argue most with the administrative staff, particularly at the dean-director level, is that I think most of them do not seize as many opportunities to make, you know, determinative decisions that really stick. The institution has gone through a period where you used to hear, I'm doing this because the president wants me to do this. I'm doing this because the president won't do this or will. And I remind those people, every time they say that I'm doing this or not doing this because of whoever's above me, they throw away any chance of having any significant power. You know, I cannot go and tell people the chancellor did this, that, or another thing. I'll never be the president. And vice presidents can't do that either. Now, I think that has changed substantially, that very few of the vice presidents do that, and very seldom do they even do that. And the most dramatic, of course, would be the vice president for academic affairs, who has to deal with so many more personnel issues and come to grips with the fact that we may disagree as well as program issues. And that I don't think you'll find the particular incumbent now ever referring, or maybe once in a while, but very seldom referring to, I did this because the president made me do it kind of thing, because it diminishes. I find too many dean director level kinds of people still attributing things to someplace up. I think most of their power is never realized, not even lost, never realized, because they don't take it and assert it, and once asserted, do it well. Because you will, I think, find the vice president saying, you know, now, and I think of particularly that in administration, finance, and campus programs, that I'm almost always supported by the president. That's not because and he leaves me alone. That's not because I've gone soft in the head, because I think what's happened is that they now, you know, make their decisions on very solid ground, very solid evidence, and people have almost ceased going over their heads, because they know that the decision is right, and it's very rarely that I have to send something back to be redone. But if it has to be redone, I warn everyone and the like, listen, if you made a mistake, don't defend it. Just say, look, we made it. Now let's go back and unscramble and do this sort of thing. So in that sense, if you're very, very hierarchical, very status-oriented, position-oriented, it is a tough administrative arrangement and the like. But if you are an assertive, well-organized manager, I think you'll find, as I can think of A. Dean in particular and the like, he gets to do pretty much what he thinks ought to be done in the institution.
One last question, and we'll run a little over, okay, but I don't want to let this one go by. It relates to the role of the Board of Trustees and their relationship to you. How tightly, and I've heard the case presented on both sides by trustees among others, how tightly do the views of the trustees circumscribe at this college what the president can do? The views on that range all the way from saying that the trustees do exactly what Dick Bjork tells them to do to some trustees who take a dim view of that and say there are certain limits within which Dick Bjork or anyone else has to operate here, or they're not going to be president. How much leeway have you had as president vis-a-vis the trustees on major issues?
Well, I don't try to assert the leeway. I think maybe the people look at it wrong. I first try to establish with the Board of Trustees at the beginning point of what are the parameters, and to get them to address these issues early in the game so that the guidelines are there from the beginning and not work it backwards and see how much I can get away with and then we'll sort of make it practice and all that. I tend to attack the thing, you know, right up front at the beginning. Now, this is the thing, we're going to do this, do we agree, sort of thing. I think you'll find trustees saying that I never go beyond the limits of the authority they believe they have given me. I don't think you'll ever find them suggesting that I have subverted any policy to which they've agreed or put on the books. In fact, if anything, I'm more likely to be a very strict interpreter of policy. And that if something is going to deviate, it's going to be reported. I'm a very prolific reporter to the Board of Trustees. So that I think their feeling of how much it is I could sort of do on my own is good, primarily because they feel informed. And I think if you feel informed about something, you feel, let that chief executive go and do those things within the general policy and guidelines of the board. My own opinion is that the board does, while they consider me a very strong administrator, an aggressive leader, an arguer for the institution and such, I think they feel that it's done very much within the parameters that they have established and they believe in, and that if I have any reservations or questions about it, I address them with them immediately, and they in the reverse. It's a very open relationship. The basic mistake observers of this system make is related to what you said about who's in whose hip pocket kind of thing, who runs whom. No one's in anyone's hip pocket, and I have advised those people, whether they be faculty, staff, union, faculty assembly, students, who try to petition the Board of Trustees in any way, shape, or form, written, personal contact, open meeting, that they all make the same mistake. And that is, they assume the trustees are not intelligent, concerned, informed. You know, they make all the wrong assumptions about the people and obviously lose every time as a consequence. Or they use ridiculous tactics such as going up and insulting a person in any way, shape, or form and then saying, now support me, I have just spit in your face, now tell me how much you love me. Well, that's outrageous. It doesn't work. Should never be tried. But there is, I think, a persistent belief that the trustees rubber stamp the president, because what people overlook is that, I hope I'm not crazy, I never put myself in a position to have the Board of Trustees deal with anything they won't support me on. And if they won't support me, it's not on the agenda, it's not going to be voted on. I mean, that's the craziest notion I've ever heard of, that the people sit around in the room expecting the trustees will overturn the president. I mean, I would be a very poor executive for them. Remember, I work for them. I'm a member of that group also. And that I'm not going to go around doing things that they're going to overturn. And so I always remind people who say, well, you know, the Board of Trustees just sits there and they go through these things and they talk a little bit and then they approve them. And says, don't you ever get defeated? Yes, but not in that forum. It's not going to occur in that forum. But every other president in this system, which just appalls me, has had a Board of Trustees in a public meeting after listening to ranting and raving overturn personnel decisions. Now, this board was well aware that would be the next day I would resign. You'd have to resign. I don't think you can tolerate that position. And as I think you've even heard new trustees tell critics from the audience about personnel decisions, we hired that person, namely the president, who's sitting there, to make those decisions within the guidelines framework we gave him. We will not touch an individual case, because they're honest enough to say they don't know anything about it. They can't know anything about it. And I think if people who want individual cases handled thought about it, they wouldn't want to touch them either, because the implications of those, nine people getting involved in the lives of every individual is, I think, not very healthy for anybody. And so they also are restrained in their own sense to saying, we want to be, in the classic sense, policy people. We don't want to run this institution on a day-to-day basis. And the interesting thing is that there are virtually no end runs to the trustees by anybody. And I think largely because the trustees make it clear that when you try that, you know, you get sent back to the to go and go back through the thing. And so people, you know, they write and do that, small things, but there's no consistent kind of lobby to work on trustees.
Dick, what's been the process by which you get a sense, if you want to propose a policy to the trustees, by which you get a sense of their opinions and the parameters they place on you so that you avoid defeat in a public meeting? Does that take place over a period of a number of meetings or in the committee meetings, or how do you get a sense of where the trustees are likely to be?
In the earlier days of the college, it took place over long, you know, discussion meetings, seminars, workshops, and this sort of thing. In recent years, because the number of policy changes involved is not very substantial, those discussions can occur more in an afternoon setting, and as we've just finished, on an annual sort of review basis where we go over existing policies and so such to see whether we're on the same track. For example, this June 1978, we spent a lot of time discussing the balance between the arts and sciences and professional studies. We spent a lot of time discussing whether or not the student service organization should continue in the ways that it has been. And out of those, I think the president can get very clear direction that will last him, you know, for a year, and know what kinds of policies to propose. But in committee meetings, which I, you know, see as an environment where differing points of view, you know, can be discussed, and I can modify mine, and they can modify theirs without sense of victory or defeat, and I think they're not concerned about the victory or defeat. But when it comes to the point of a decision, you know, they're all on board, and they do have a very strong sense that, all right, I had my chance, I tried to persuade, and the like, and now I'll support. They do believe in that.
Okay. We run a little over. I think we can wrap this session up, and there's one more. Thank you.
Okay.